Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hey, it's Jonathan from Good Life Project. If you are in your 30s or 40s with friends too busy to join you on a vacation, you have to check out Flashpack, the only group travel brand for solo travelers your age. Imagine dining with sumos in Japan or basking on a private yacht in Croatia, all with people like you. Visit flashpack.com/podcast to save $250 on your booking, an offer only available until July 15th.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Monday, the 5th of June. Pro-Ukrainian Russian fighters say two soldiers they captured in Russia will be handed over to Ukraine. The deputy head of Sudan's ruling council has called for the withdrawal of all forces from the capital Khartoum. And hundreds of thousands of people join an anti-government rally in Poland. Also in the podcast, why Syria's monopoly on the addictive drug Captagon is worrying many of its Arab neighbours. And could gay marriage be on the cards in Thailand?
What I can say with certainty is that this year's Bangkok Pride will be the last where LGBTQ plus couples can still not get married in Thailand.
Vladimir Putin has long claimed his invasion of Ukraine is supposed to make Russia safer. But for the people of Belgorod, the opposite is true. In recent weeks, the southern Russian region has been hit by cross-border raids, apparently carried out by Russian partisans opposed to President Putin and based in Ukraine. On Sunday, fighters from the Russian Volunteer Corps said they'd captured two Russian soldiers in Belgorod. They offered to release them in return for a meeting with the region's governor. But when he failed to turn up, they said the prisoners of war would be handed over to Ukraine. The head of the Wagner mercenaries, meanwhile, has stepped up his criticism of Russia's military leaders over their failure to defend Belgorod.
Для чего десятки тысяч людей, наших русских парней?
Why are thousands of our Russian guys dying in Ukraine, says Yevgeny Prigozhin. Is it so we can give up pieces of Belgorod, our primordial Russian land? He'd earlier threatened to send in Wagner fighters to defend the region without seeking permission from the Russian authorities. So what exactly is going on in Belgorod? I asked our correspondent James Waterhouse in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv.
It started a week ago where you have anti-Kremlin, pro-Ukrainian Russian nationals, these paramilitaries, who are not part of the Ukrainian military, but they are connected to Ukraine's intelligence service. They have apparently crossed the border, where they are now claiming to have taken a number of villages and settlements close to the border inside Russia. In their words, setting up so-called people's republics. It's a very strange, almost mirror image of what Russia has been doing to Ukraine for the past 9 years. Now, it is a scratching of the surface in comparison to what Russia has done to Ukraine. But we've seen increased shelling for the past few days. We've seen sustained violence. And what this is doing is two things. It is firstly drawing Russian forces. It is making Russia effectively have to turn its back to deal with this security breach. And what it does secondly is that it taps into one of Vladimir Putin's biggest concerns, which is internal consumption, which is him trying to convince the Russian people that the war in Ukraine is just and that it's going according to plan. And I think there'll be some corners in Kyiv privately delighted with what is going on there.
And we've seen these partisans almost taunting the Russians, offering to free the people they say they captured in return for a brief meeting in a church with the governor of Belgorod, and then saying, well, you didn't turn up, we're going to hand these men over to the Ukrainians. What more is known about these groups that are involved?
Well, they're made up of Russian fighters, as you say. These are men who have fought for Ukrainian forces in the past. They are also made up of Polish nationals, they claim, and what Ukraine is saying officially is that they have nothing to do with their recent incursion. But there are big question marks on that. These are two groups of volunteers who not only made their way across the border in the northeastern Sumy region, which takes organisation, but they appear to have used Western armoured vehicles and weapons and uniforms. So it's got Ukrainian-looking fingerprints all over it. And I think there'll be some Western allies sitting a bit uncomfortably, because what Western allies, notably the US, have said, the war in Ukraine needs to remain inside Ukraine. If we're going to give you long-range missiles, you fire them on targets inside Ukraine. Why? Because they're worried about World War III. They're worried about this war spreading and spreading quickly.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. And in the past few minutes, as we record this podcast, Russia is saying that Ukraine's counter-offensive has begun. It said the Russian chief of staff and armed forces, General Gerasimov, was at a control point when Kyiv launched a large-scale operation. The Russian Defense Ministry says that Ukrainian forces were unsuccessful in attempts to break through Russian defenses. And no doubt we'll have more on that if it is indeed the Ukrainian counteroffensive in the next edition of the Global News podcast. It is 51 days since rivalry between the two sides of Sudan's armed forces erupted into open conflict. As many as 1,800 people have been killed, according to one monitoring group. The latest ceasefire expired on Saturday night, and fighting between the regular army and the rapid support forces intensified once again. Malik Agar, the deputy to Sudan's de facto military ruler, has told the BBC there is an urgent need to facilitate the withdrawal of troops from residential areas, saying no truce could hold while Khartoum was full of militia.
The issue is not just to agree on a ceasefire, because for this to be meaningful, it needs to involve the withdrawal of forces from public institutions and residential areas, and this needs clear mechanisms for it to be implemented.
We got more details of the fighting from our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton.
The paramilitary, the rapid support forces, claimed to have shot down an army fighter jet in northern Khartoum. But for their part, the Sudanese military said that it had crashed because of what they called a technical malfunction. There's also been live footage of black smoke billowing across the city, and also reports of gunfire and clashes and anti-aircraft gunfire near the international airport in Khartoum, which is a key target. The paramilitary are trying to get control of places like the airport, the presidential palace, the state broadcaster. On Friday, they entered the National Museum, and there were fears about vandalizing priceless relics there. In terms of the wider problem, now that the ceasefire has collapsed, it looks as if the army is getting ready for a major offensive to flush out the paramilitary, the RSF.
Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton. The nationalist government in Poland has long been accused of trying to tighten its grip on power. On Sunday, it faced one of the biggest demonstrations since the fall of communism in 1989. An estimated 500,000 people marched through the capital, Warsaw, over a new law that they fear could be used against the main opposition leader and former Prime Minister, Donald Tusk. The demonstrators are also angry about inflation, the cost of living, and what some see as an erosion of LGBT and women's rights. Protesters chanted for a return to democracy. Well, Mr. Tusk himself was at the rally and told the crowd that Poles would not be silenced.
The first step to victory is to recognise our strength. We're here today so that Poland, Europe and the world see how strong we are, how many of us are ready, just like back then, 30, 40 years ago, to fight again for a democratic and free Poland, for our rights.
Well, our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, told us more.
The law that you were talking about there, Ollie, clearly gave focus to wider concerns about democratic backsliding, allegations, incidentally, which the governing Law and Justice Party reject out of hand. But the commission that's been set up has very wide powers, including preventing people deemed to have been under Russian influence from using public funds for up to 10 years. That would constitute effectively a ban from office. And it will investigate things, for example, like energy deals that were struck since 2007 to see if they ran counter to the interests of the Polish state. Now, 2007 was, of course, the year that Donald Tusk became prime minister. So critics in the opposition have called the nickname this the Lex Tusk, the Tusk Law. And they say that basically it's a Bolshevik measure designed to keep him out of the election that's coming up this year in October or November.
So lots of criticism. The president's responded by saying he'll propose amendments to the law. Will that placate the protesters?
Yeah, President Duda said that having just signed the law into effect on Monday, now says it needs to be amended, and that he's proposed, for example, not allowing MPs or senators to sit on the commission, just experts, and that they wouldn't have a banning power from office, and that the people would have recourse to the courts. But it's not clear if and when those amendments will be passed. Also, people say, because the commission will report in September, that anyone who then has to go through the courts, the election would have happened by that. So they want the whole law scrapped.
Danny Eberhard. The Indian Railway Minister says he believes faulty signalling equipment may have been to blame for the triple train crash on Friday evening. More than 275 people died in the accident in Odisha state. Slightly fewer than was announced on Saturday because of double counting. Wreckage is still being cleared from the tracks. Our correspondent at the scene, Archana Shukla, has the latest.
Indian officials are trying to pinpoint what led to a train carrying more than 1,000 passengers colliding with a goods train parked in a siding. Another train passing in the opposite direction then hit the derailed coaches. India's Railway Minister Ashwini Vaishnav suggested signal equipment was to blame, but wouldn't be drawn further.
It's about the point machine and the electronic interlocking system in this matter. The change in the electronic interlocking system caused this accident, and whoever did it, and whatever the reasons are, will be known after the investigation.
Mr. Vaishnav urged everyone to wait for the final investigation report. The driver of the train survived the crash and has said he did not jump a red signal. There have been calls in India for ministers and high-ranking officials to resign. Pressure is also mounting on the government to abandon the flagship program of introducing more high-speed trains and instead focus on safety. Efforts are now underway to restart rail services in the region. Families who have been unable to trace their relatives are travelling to the site. More than 180 bodies remain unidentified and officials have started uploading pictures on government websites.
Archana Shukla in India. 34 years ago, the communist government in China brutally put down the pro-democracy protests in Tiananmen Square in Beijing.
They were about 250 yards away. Young people were singing the Internationale to a background of gunfire. After hours of shooting and facing a line of troops, the crowd is still here. They're shouting, "Stop the killing and down with the government."
The BBC's Kate Ady reporting from Tiananmen Square on the events of the 4th of June 1989. Thousands of people died, but China has tried to erase any memory of the massacre. In Hong Kong, huge numbers of police were deployed to ensure no one attended the annual commemorative events, which are now banned under a new security law imposed by Beijing. On Sunday, 23 people, including prominent pro-democracy activists, were detained on suspicion of what the authorities in Hong Kong called breaching the peace. Louisa Lim is an award-winning journalist who reported from China for a decade for the BBC and US National Public Radio. She's author of The People's Republic of Amnesia, Tiananmen Revisited.
As far as I'm aware, Hong Kong was the only place within China where there were attempts today to remember what happened 34 years ago. But if you think about it, 4 years ago in Hong Kong, 190,000 people came out. Today in Hong Kong, standing on the street holding flowers is enough to get you taken away by police. I mean, Hong Kong's authorities have refused to say whether or not it's legal to remember June the 4th, but it seems clear from what's happening on the streets that even people who are just wearing black are being questioned or taken away. So there really is an effort to absolutely suppress any public acts of memory, both in Hong Kong and in China, where that's long been the case. over the past few years, there used to be people who posted online emojis and pictures of candles and pictures of flowers and photographs, which are harder to censor. But now the restrictions are becoming more and more intense. So this year, there were even these instructions given out to censors, not even to allow a sensitive number of likes on a post. So if your post was coming up for 64, because 64 is June the 4th in Chinese, if your post was coming up to 64 or 640 or 6,400 likes, the order was to censors to sort of watch out and stop that from happening.
Louisa Lim, author of The People's Republic of Amnesia, Tiananmen Revisited. Saudi Arabia has announced deep cuts in oil production from next month. It's part of a broader deal by the OPEC cartel and its allies, including Russia, to shore up prices by limiting supplies into 2024. Bethany Bell reports from Vienna, where OPEC is based.
The Saudi energy minister, Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, said the cut of a million barrels a day could be extended beyond July if necessary. This is a Saudi lollipop, he said, to stabilise the oil market. In April, several OPEC Plus members agreed to voluntarily cut production by more than 1 million barrels per day, a surprise move that briefly saw an increase in prices but failed to bring about lasting recovery. Oil producers are grappling with falling prices and high market volatility amidst the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Bethany Bell. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
There is a perception of the idea of a second great moon race, rather like that in the 1960s, except that this time it's the US and its allies versus China.
In the Cold War era, it was Russia against America. But who will win the new space race? After welcoming Syria's president back into the Arab League, leaders in the region are hoping to persuade him to take action against the flourishing trade in narcotics produced in Syria. In March, Iraqi guards at the Syrian border seized more than 3 million Captagon pills, a highly addictive and lucrative amphetamine. The Syrian government denies any role in the trade, but the Syrian foreign minister, Faisal Mekdad, has been in Baghdad to discuss the issue with his Iraqi counterpart, Fuad Hussein. I heard more about Syria's role in the drug trade from our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
Well, the Syrian role is absolutely central. The more than 10 years of the war has been the perfect, most fertile ground for the production of Captagon. Syria is believed to produce 80% of it in the world. And through that production and through the ability to smuggle, through militias, warlords being involved, officials almost certainly in governments also being involved, it's meant that the market has increased too. Much as the drug heads towards the Gulf, where it's hugely popular, it's beginning to take hold in Iraq and Jordan and some of the stopping off points where it's been smuggled through up until now. So this is a major, major issue, and one that very much was at the forefront of Arab countries and what they wanted to have tackled when they allowed Syria back into the Arab League. To some extent, almost immediately after Syria went back into the Arab League, there was a big operation in Jordan in which one of the main Syrian drug traffickers was eliminated. The problem is that almost certainly, beyond certainty, although they deny it, President Assad, his regime, is deeply involved in this. It's been a financial lifeline to President Assad. So how willing will he be to give it up? There's certainly action that the Syrian government can do, but would it actually root and branch, try to eliminate it? Very unlikely.
Sebastian Usher. It's been all change at China's orbiting space station. Last Tuesday, a new three-person crew was sent up to replace three astronauts who returned on Sunday after a six-month tour. China built its own space station after it was excluded from the international version over US security concerns. And it's now seriously competing with the Americans, planning to land a man on the moon by 2030. Brian Harvey is author of China in Space, The Great Leap Forward. Julian Marshall asked him what China does on its space station.
The Chinese have three Hang Tianyuan, or astronauts as we call them, on board their orbital space station, carrying out a series of experiments in the area of medicine, being how long can people stay in space and what are the countermeasures that you need to take for weightlessness so as to prepare for long distance flights to the moon and Mars. They're doing experiments with flames, with mineral processing. They're making a lot of observations of the Earth so as to better assess, for example, land resources.
Is this similar to what's going on the International Space Station?
Very similar to that, except that the Chinese Tiangong space station, it's about one quarter the size of the International Space Station.
But the Chinese space station presumably is aiding China in its own space program and its desire to explore outer space.
The International Space Station was set up in 1998 and it is aging quite a lot at the moment. NASA has decided to terminate the International Space Station in 2031. But China's space station was set up 2 years ago, and it is expected that the Chinese station will continue to fly long past the ISS and indeed way into the 2040s, if not even further.
So that's going to give China a tactical advantage in the space race, would you say?
It will. Now, the Americans say that they will introduce commercial stations from the end of this decade onwards. The Chinese certainly can offer definite continuity with their Tiangong space station. But it's also worth noting that in the past 2 weeks, China has stated that it does intend to send its first astronauts to the moon before 2030. And that has rather upped the stakes with the United States because the US already has it in plan with the Artemis program to land its first astronauts back on the moon after Apollo in the next number of years. So there is a perception of the idea of a second great moon race, rather like that in the 1960s, except that this time it's the US and its allies versus China. On the face of things, the United States is set to get back to the moon first. However, the Americans are using a lot of quite untested technology in the form particularly of the Starship, which suffered a catastrophic accident during its first attempted orbital launch only a couple of weeks ago. If that is delayed, it's quite possible that the Chinese, who have a much more conservative technological approach, could actually get there first in the end.
Brian Harvey talking to Julian Marshall. According to UN estimates, India recently overtook China as the world's most populous nation. As India's population grows, an increasing number of families there are headed by women. For a traditionally patriarchal society, where men have been the main breadwinners and decision makers, the trend is significant. Our India correspondent Divya Arya has been looking at how this demographic change is being reflected in daily life.
With three daughters and one son, Usha's is a big family. She never wanted this, but Usha Devi was only 15 when she was married off in one of India's poorest states, Bihar. Faced with her in-laws' preference for a son, she had to give in and keep trying.
After having two daughters, I thought if I get them good education, they'd be no less powerful than boys. Can only sons do everything?
There are so many unsaid rules that women have to follow here, like cover their head when in the presence of men outside their home, cook the food but serve the men and children first, and then do with whatever's left. Girls can't be outside the home till late, while men can roam around free. And if women were to interact with men outside of their family, they could be labeled loose. So in all of this, if women are to head families, interact with the outside world, and take decisions, that means breaking almost all the rules in the book.
For Usha, that opening emerged out of a crisis. With few jobs in the village, her husband had to migrate to find work, leaving behind Usha to take charge of their family. Sonalde Desai is a sociologist and demographer.
One is that the wife continues to live with her in-laws, in which case she's much more of a dependent on her in-laws and older brothers-in-law and so on. But in cases where she's able to establish an independent household by herself, we see a real change in her ability to make decisions, taking care of some of the financial responsibilities, even managing and running the farm.
Usha moved out of her in-laws' home and found work. It brought money in and gave her an identity.
Identity is not a small thing. You may earn respect for a short time by flaunting your wealth, but the hard-earned identity of a self-made person is lifelong.
Independent, confident Usha is now a leader amongst women in her village. When she speaks, they listen. For Usha's eldest daughter, Rashmi, her mother is her hero.
I saw my mother change and I thought, I can also become like her.
Rashmi teaches English, Hindi and math to children in the village to supplement the household income and dreams of saving enough to train to become a policewoman. It's not only a career goal. She wants to set an example, just like her mother.
A report from India by Divya Arya. Now, is there such a thing as Eastern Europe? Well, author and historian Jacob Michanowski thinks the phrase is an outsider's convenience. To explain his point, Mr. Michanowski, who was born in Poland but who's been living in the US for decades, went back to the region, travelling from Latvia in the Baltics to Albania in the Mediterranean South. The result is a book entitled Goodbye Eastern Europe. He told Julian Warriker why there is no such thing as Eastern Europe, at least in the geographical sense of the phrase.
For the most part, it is something, I think, as Eastern Europeans, we discover abroad in the United Kingdom or in America. We get grouped or lumped together in a way that people tend not to see themselves, especially after 89. Countries have really fled that name or that label because I think it carries a stigma. My part of Eastern Europe, Poland, really has identified as a Central European country. So as Hungary, so as the Czech and Slovak parts of Czechoslovakia. The Baltics have associated themselves with Scandinavia or Nordic zone. Parts of the Balkans have found ways to also change that label. The one area where that might not be true is the old western border of the Soviet Union. Moldova, Ukraine, Belarus will still identify with Eastern Europe. They don't really necessarily have a choice. But even there was initiative at one point for Ukraine to rebrand itself as a Southern European or Mediterranean country, which sounds a little bit paradoxical, but they do have a little bit of that Greek path, that Black Sea coast. But anything to get away from the heaviness of that name.
Heaviness because of the system it was once associated with.
The system it was associated with, the feeling of backwardness and underdevelopment it represents historically, and also the deeper history of bloodshed and turmoil, and to get away from that. And for me, though, I think there's more to it. I think it isn't just a 20th century construct. I think there's a deeper history of an Eastern Europe of distinctiveness from Western Europe on one side and Russia on the other. A different kind of society, different kind of mingling of cultures and religions. And that's something I'm trying to recapture in this book.
What have you learned about your own personal story in the research of this book that you perhaps didn't know before?
I used my own family history as a sort of plumb line. It's a pretty extraordinary history. And I discovered quite a bit that I didn't know, that my family didn't necessarily know. My family's mixed Polish-Jewish, so Polish Catholic and Polish Jewish. And there's a lot of secrets buried in that, too. Got into my grandfather's past. My grandfather had the same name as me. And he had a difficult wartime past as a partisan, as a wartime communist fighter in the Red Army, and afterwards as a counterintelligence officer, working one of the great Cold War deception jobs of the early 1950s, false flag operations against the West. So his whole past was new. And then the past, the Jewish side of the family that died in the Holocaust, most perished without a trace in the Warsaw Ghetto, which was such an enormous black hole. But one single document buried in a milk can that Yiddish activists in the Warsaw Ghetto created and preserved and then buried, and those archives kept in kind of a great steel jar, was dug up in 1950 and took years to catalog. And there's one document from someone who witnessed my great aunt's execution. She was killed early in the war, early enough that the execution of, I think, 16 other girls. And an eyewitness in prison with her wrote very movingly of what happened that day in 1941. And I have so this one sheet in Polish. And that's something I uncovered, something my parents didn't know about, which I included in the chapter on the war.
That's quite a discovery, I can imagine.
Yeah, I actually have trouble. I was just doing the audiobook, and I always, whenever I come to that document, I have to stop. It's just, it's an incredible moment in time, and I just find it so moving, but also just so heartbreaking. She was killed along with her infant son, who was also named Jacob, would have been my mother's cousin. I mean, there are dozens of other family members, but I have this one tangible trace, this one kind of contact in time. And that's what I was looking for a lot with this book, isn't the story of dictators or of generals, but individual stories. So there are stories from my family, but there are also stories of other regular people encountering history in their bodies, in their lives, not always as tragically, sometimes.
Jacob Mikanowski talking to Julian Warraker. Thousands of people have taken part in a pride march in the Thai capital, Bangkok, calling for same-sex marriage and gender identity rights. And this year, they may have more hope of being listened to by the authorities. In the general election last month, Thai voters firmly rejected the incumbent military rulers in favour of opposition parties promising reform. Jonathan Head reports from the scene.
So I'm down in the centre of Bangkok at Bangkok Pride 2023. And this year, they're hoping for a couple of significant things to come out of the advocacy that comes through these marches. One, and they're talking about this as being a gate to equal Asia, is to send a signal to other countries in the region, which are far worse than Thailand when it comes to recognising the rights of LGBTQ people. Countries like Malaysia and Indonesia, where there are serious legal sanctions, punishments, Thailand is way ahead of them, but also to focus on the areas where Thailand still has to enact full rights, particularly equal marriage. And the reason there's been quite a lot of excitement here today is because in the recent election, a young progressive party did better than any other and is poised to form a government. And among its raft of reformist policies is a full commitment to equal marriage. So it's very appropriate I'm here today with Parit Wacharasin, who is the policy campaign manager for that party, Move Forward. Parit, I mean, given your policy commitments, how does it feel to be here just a couple of weeks after your election win?
The timing of this year's event is particularly exciting because it's being held in a time where the public is anticipating the passage of a marriage equality bill that's been stuck in Parliament since the last parliamentary term. As a coalition government, we will try to make sure that this law comes into reality within the first 100 days of the next government. And I think what I can say with certainty is that this year's Bangkok Pride will be the last Bangkok Pride where LGBTQ plus couples can still not get married in Thailand.
Why has it taken so long? Because everybody knows Thailand as a country that's generally very accepting and welcoming to LGBTQ people.
Thailand has been stuck in a tug of war between an increasingly progressive society and a repressive set of laws and political system. So we've been trying to, you know, amend the laws and the system to catch up with the increasingly progressive society. But as we've seen, the government that's been in power for the past 4 years was one that, you know, continued from the military regime that stayed
very conservative, I guess.
Yes, they don't see the same future of Thailand as we do. So I think this year's election is an important pivotal point in Thailand's political history, because it means that, you know, as Move Forward Party, we have a chance to, you know, amend and reform these regressive laws and system to catch up with an increasingly progressive society. And then that goes beyond just the issue of gender equality, but it also resonates in Move Forward Party's agenda to democratize the country, to demilitarize and take the military out of Thai politics, as well as to demonopolize and ensure we have free and fair economic competition.
Do you think Thai society is genuinely ready for full equal rights for LGBTQ people?
The answer is 100% yes, and I think there's a broad public consensus on this issue for a while. We have to reiterate that what we are proposing regarding marriage equality is a very simple yet very important proposal, which is the idea that every couple, regardless of their gender or sexual orientation, should have an equal right to marry. We know to have a healthy and fully fledged democracy will require more than just free and fair elections. It also means equal protection of people's rights and liberties, one of which is an equal right to marry.
Parit Wacharasin talking to Jonathan Head in Bangkok. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Graham White and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Hey, it's Jonathan from Good Life Project. If you are in your 30s or 40s with friends too busy to join you on a vacation, you have to check out Flashpack, the only group travel brand for solo travelers your age. Imagine dining with sumos in Japan or basking on a private yacht in Croatia, all with people like you. Visit flashpack.com/podcast to save $250 on your booking, and offer only available until July 15th.